Great, thanks. Well, good morning, everyone. Thanks for coming, and thanks also for acknowledging Tanya and Tana May, who are currently enjoying the Alaska winter while we're here in Honolulu. To give you an idea of what we're going to do now, our goal today is to describe the development of Kek Adi Nach, which is Alaska's first digital language archive, to be indigenously administered and also OLAC compliant. So what's coming up, Karen is going to talk for a few minutes about who we are and why there is a need for such an archive in Alaska. And then I'll talk a little bit about what we did to build the archive and some thoughts on our future plans, and then Karen's going to make some concluding remarks.
Good morning. The Otna community, or Otna region, is comprised of 8 modern villages along the Copper and Susitna valleys. It's one of the 11 Athabaskan speaking groups. Currently, we have approximately 30 elders still fluent in Otna and both bilingual with English. There's an extremely strong interest in learning more about our language and our culture and preserving those. The Otna Heritage Foundation is a nonprofit organization that was formed in the mid-80s by Otna Incorporated, one of the 13 regional Alaskan Native Claims Settlement Act corporations. And our mission is to strengthen our people by preserving and promoting the Otna culture and supporting education. Doing this, which was a natural fit for our archive, and doing this, creating a place for our people to learn more about our history, listen to some of the speakers who are now passed. We also promote our culture through our Otna Heritage Dancers. We have hosted a cultural summit where we got together with all the eight villages, came together to discuss our concerns and needs for preserving the culture. And through that, some of this archiving project and our DOE grant, which is starting an infant learning program, was started. And one of our elders told us that to reach the parents, just having language classes isn't going to work. You need to teach the young children. And through that, you'll reach the parents as well. So that's why we're doing the infant learning program. The size of our corpus, the collections that we've gotten so far, Otna Heritage Foundation had several, about 150 or so tapes. The Alaska Native Language Archive had a large deposit that they've amassed over a couple decades. There's a 14H1, which is a part of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, on preserving historic and cemetery sites. And so there were interviews done with several elders over about 10 years that were done to find those locations and the history behind that. So that's an important part of why we have this archive. The OTHB backscatter was the Over the Horizon backscatter program that was going to be a Air Force research project that was going to be in the area and has now changed to HARP. The Copper River Native Association is a sister nonprofit organization that had several programs over from the mid-60s through the 80s on cultural programs, education programs, creating curriculum. They did things on plant uses and things like that, medicinal uses and food preparations and that kind of thing. So those are parts of their collection. Chickaloon Village has also gotten a collection. Chickaloon is another Otna-speaking village, but is not part of the Otna region proper. The Bureau of Indian Affairs had done some interviews and things through the formation of ANCSA and other and through the 14H process. So also we have, because of this archive process, we've also gotten private collections that have been offered up. And some of them are quite significant in size. We have a young man who came forward with a collection of about 400 tapes that his grandmother had recorded over 30 years of potlatches, and not just the songs are on those, but also the speech making, you know, 30 years of Chief Walter Northway from Upper Tanana, Chief Andrew Isaac, also from Tanacross, and we have our traditional chief was Jim McKinley, my grandfather, Frank Charlie. I mean, there's a lot of history in those speeches on how we're related and interrelated and things like that. So that in itself is one project that I just can't wait to get my hands on. And the other one is the songs. A lot of the songs are getting lost. We've got maybe about 20 or so songs now that we still continue to use, or there might be more, but there are older songs that have been lost. And, you know, I hope through this project that I'd be able to recover some of those and be able to pass that forward to my grandchildren. Now you see our need for the local archive, you know? It's huge. There's so much there. In 2009, we had roughly about 11 meetings throughout the villages. It brought an increased awareness of the tapes that are out there. And then there's also questions brought up, well, who owns the rights to those tapes and who owns the rights to those recordings? Not only the personal collections, but those done by researchers and those done by ourselves when we did our own research as to ownership. And then there's also the greater desire now to gain access to those tapes. So we've always known that they've been out there, but the collection at the Alaska Native Language Archive was in Fairbanks, which is 250, 300 miles away. You know, and so not easily accessible. There was a catalog list of names, possible dates of recordings, but nothing on the content. And the same with the Otna collection. And that they were up in an attic at the office and not easily accessible. And as far as content on those was pretty much non-existent. It said, you know, we interviewed Buster Jean on this date, and that was it. So to protect these recordings in their fragile state, because actually some of them were stored outside in an old bake shack that, you know, was leaky, and so it would be hot in the summer and freezing in the winter, they increased the vulnerability of the cassettes. And so a lot... irreplaceable history and knowledge on these tapes. So there's that need to protect it, and therefore the urgency for digitizing the information. We needed to involve our elders in the process, and this happened kind of by accident. We had gotten invited to an elders luncheon, and Andrea, with one of her cohorts that gives her all her information. Anyway, and we were talking, and I went to explain my project. And we'd just gotten the funding, and I went and told them, you know, we're going to start this digital archive. And the first thing that they wanted to know was, who's going to have access to that? How are you going to protect us and our knowledge? And so, through this, we had several more meetings. Policies were written. We were able to talk with the elders and get this information out to them and, you know, protect their and address their concerns.
Okay. All right. So you can see that we're estimating there's somewhere between 3,000 and 5,000 hours worth of recordings all spread all across the state that are relating to Otna. Obviously, the first thing that we're going to need is some money. So in spring 2009, we applied for a grant to the Institute for Museum and Library Services. This is a federal funding organization that has a program for Native American libraries. And we'd already received one of their
basic grant,
kind of a startup grant. And after you get that, you can then apply for an enhancement grant. Which I'm happy to say that the following fall we were awarded by them nearly $150,000 to be spent over 2 years. And we also managed to get about $40,000 in cost sharing from the Otna Heritage Foundation, from the University of Alaska, and also I contributed a good deal of my own time. This money went to things like hiring the staff. It also went to maintaining the facility that I'm going to show you in the next slide. It also went to equipment purchases and a little bit of travel. That's pretty much it. Yep. And work began in early 2010. Once we hired the staff, we were able to get started. The archive is housed in this building here. This is the Otna Cultural Center, which is on the property of the Wrangell-St. Elias National Park. This is the country's largest national park. It's located on Otna territory. This is traditional Otna hunting territory, in fact. And the building here was funded by an appropriation that was funneled through the park, but the building belongs to Otna Incorporated now. And that facility is used as kind of a museum. There's an exhibit area, and people can stop by and see cultural exhibits. And then in the back, there's some office space, and that's where the archive is. And we were able to purchase with our funding a professional quality suite of digitization equipment. We have all kinds of things. If anyone wants to see a list later, I'm happy to share it with you. We have an analog digital converter, a dual cassette deck, VHS and video converter. We have a really nice set of monitors, a control center, a rack with power. We have 2 terabyte RAID storage on site, and later I'll talk about some off-site storage that we have as well. And then we bought a fireproof cabinet for the storage of the actual tapes, although this can't hold nearly all the tapes that we have, but this area is prone to forest fire, so we wanted to be able to protect what we at least a small part of the collection. And I should say that we modeled the equipment purchase based on the archive that's here at University of Hawaii. We had a nice partnership with Kaipule Ohone, which is of a similar scope and size to our collection. All right. Karen's going to talk about how the elders were involved.
We had an elders' tea and, again, explained our project and more of the finalized policies that we had for access, the general access policies, and getting their seal of approval was an important part of creating our archive. The elders come and they listen to recordings, whatever we happen to be doing that day, not searching for anything in particular, just whatever we're listening to that day. They'll come and listen and they'll give us input as to what's on that tape. It might be we can pick out words here and there, as Tana Mae and I aren't fluent, but we get the gist of what's in there, but they would be able to come out and really enrich our data. They chose a name for this facility.
I'll explain the name here. Oh, I also want to say that of all the archives on OLAC, we have some of the richest descriptive metadata that's there, and that's because of the elders. So this is just some geekiness for the linguists in the room. The name of the archive is Kek Adi Nach. This is built on, this is kind of an indefinite prefix here. This K'a here is sort of a postposition that when you nominalize it, gets the idea of cavity. And Nach means house. But together, this word Kek Adi has the sense of meaning the things that deceased people leave behind, not only their material objects, but also their memories and their lessons and their values. And so we're calling the archive Legacy House. That's how we've translated that term. Okay. Training. So we brought in some outside training. First of all, we hired, this is Tana Mae Pete here in the foreground. She is actually the daughter of two of the elders that have been very active in language work over the years. And she is our technical assistant, and she's done most of the archiving and most of the metadata input. But we did bring in an outside consultant, James Crippen, who's right here in the room. James was at the time a student here at the University of Hawaii, and so he was familiar with the Kaipule Ohone archive. And he came up and he helped us to build the database, which is currently FileMaker Pro. He taught us how to digitize, how to use the equipment, how to digitize the tapes. He taught us about tape curation. There was one day where we actually took apart a tape, and you know, what do you do if your tape is all stuck together because it's, you know, it's very old, and sort of how to
repair it,
how to coax it apart and put it into a new shell if you need to. And also taught us about metadata collection. And James was actually the perfect guy to do this. Not only is he an excellent linguist and familiar with archiving, but he's also an Alaska Native himself. He's of Tlingit descent, and the Tlingit and the Athabascans have a long history of cultural sharing up and down the Copper River. So he made quite a splash when he got there, and quite some friendships, I think, formed that week. Policies has actually been an area that Karen's been spending a lot of time working on because this is one of the thorniest issues that we have to deal with. We do have some acquisition policies in place. We have a deposit form that has, it's sort of a generalized deposit form, and you can specify who has access and thank you, and for how long. There's also a sunset clause in there that will, in 25 years, your materials will then become property of the archive, I believe, and then the archive can decide who it gets, who will get access to it. There's also some very general access policies in place right now, such that ATNA people have a certain level of access to the collection. The non-ATNA general population has a different level of access to the collection, and then also researchers who are working in cooperation with ATNA Heritage Foundation who have an established relationship have a different level of archive of access to the collection. But I should say that this is all very much still in development, and this is an area that we're hoping for some input from other people on as well, because there are issues about information that's very specific to particular clans or to particular families, and it's not totally clear how to handle that. A lot of places, a lot of other archives just say that they handle it on a case-by-case basis, and that's kind of hard for other archives to learn from.
You know, this is a good, on the case-to-case basis, will work for now because we have a vested interest in the archive where and a certain level of cultural sensitivity. But in 20 years from now, when Tanya or myself aren't there, who's going to protect those interests? And so having a written policy would help to protect those interests.
One of the other policies that the depositors can specify who in the community can take over decisions. So the things that I deposited with the archive, I have actually specified Tana May as being the one that if I'm no longer available, she is now in charge of my collection because it's mostly her parents that are on the recordings. Okay, so far what we've done is we've digitized 17,000 minutes, which is a fancy way of saying about, it's a dramatic way of saying 300 hours. which is about what we promised in this current grant, and it includes most of the collections that we mentioned earlier. We're right now working on the Copper River Native Association collection, and then coming in the future is the Chickaloon has amassed a large collection, and also the BIA, and then we're hoping to open it up to more of the private individuals in the community very soon. One of the really important things that's developed out of this project is that we have a memorandum of agreement with the Alaska Native Language Archive in Fairbanks. And I want to say that under the direction of Gary Holton, the ANLA has been very, very good about working with us in sort of moving forward and being progressive about archiving in the state. And they've shared their entire ATNA collection with us. They just handed it over. And in return,
already digitized.
And in return, like Karen said, we were able to enrich the metadata and give that back to them. Another important thing that they're offering us is gray storage backup in perpetuity. So gray storage is where they're just keeping all of our files at the university on the servers, but they're not looking inside. They have no access to the contents of what's going on. But they are holding this material for us for two reasons. First of all, like I said, the region is prone to forest fires, and lots of copies keep stuff safe. So we have a copy off-site. Also, in the event that we have a year where the ATNA Heritage Foundation cannot fund the archive and we're looking for other funding, we don't just turn off all the equipment and go home for a year. The university will just hold all of this material until we can get funding again. Okay? And then finally, and this is probably the most important thing that's come out of the MOA, is that all of the decisions about access to the ATNA collection in Fairbanks at the university are now handed over to ATNA Heritage. The ANLA realizes that they do not fully have the authority to make decisions about who has access to everything, so they've just simply decided that ATNA Heritage Foundation is really the best body to do that, and they said that anytime we get requests coming in, we'll just hand it over to you. And I think that that's a really very valuable thing that's come out of this.
It's one of the things that's most amazing, because that was one of our biggest concerns is, you know, a lot of collections, even BIA and the 14H1 investigations that were done for historical sites, were just deposited. There were no deposit forms. They were just said, here, you guys keep a copy. And so keeping our historical sites private is important to ATNA people. So, you know, Gary has been amazing in recognizing that there's certain levels of access that needs to be controlled. And he said, I don't want to be that gatekeeper. Yeah. Who's better to do it than the ATNA people.
Right.
So it was a really nice partnership that was formed through this. Thank you, Gary.
Okay, I see we only have a couple of minutes left. I'm proud to say that in December of this past year, we joined OLAC. Which is really great. It means that we're now participating in a global network of language archives, which means basically that our metadata adheres to international standards, although we need to clean it up just a little bit still, so don't look yet. But, it's also discoverable online, which is very important, as you know. And we're happy to say we're the first member of OLAC to be run by an Indigenous American organization, which I think is a nice thing. Thank you. Really quickly, some future plans. We want to really increase the access to the collection. So the first thing we're going to do is this summer, we're opening a public workstation in the Cultural Center so that Atna people and also visitors, we get a lot of tour buses that come through the Cultural Center, can come and listen to portions of the collection. Browse the catalog. Our next big push is over the next 2 years is to build network workstations in all of the villages so that local people in the villages can access the collection. And we also would like to integrate a public comments feature at those workstations so that people can enrich the metadata. Oh, this is my uncle. Let me tell you who this was. You know, so we can just continue to know more about what's on the recordings. Another long-term goal of this, of course, is to now that we have access to the contents of the recording, we can build on that to further cultural and linguistic revitalization in the Atna area. And a really long-term goal that we have is we really like to build support a network of archives in Alaska that's similar to what we have. So working with the Alaska Native Language Archive, these are all of the
regions.
Yeah, thank you. The regional corporations. We're hoping that other groups will be interested in doing that and that we can kind of work with them and teach them and share ideas on how we might do this better across the state and build a real network. Okay. So in conclusion,
Native language archiving in Alaska has been traditionally done by institutions who had know-how, access to technology, and funding. Where now, know-how is more accessible, technology is cheaper, and funding is more widespread. Archives that are administered locally can better mobilize language materials. We can share this information with our people, and they can learn more and do more with their own knowledge, while partnering with academic atmospheres too, getting data backup, technical training, and networking. It's possible to create a language archive that increases local ownership and access to the language, can be housed and run locally, can address all of the local concerns and the concerns of our elders. It meets international standards. It builds partnerships. We've created partnerships with ANLA, with Copper River Native Association, with with the University of Hawaii in building this. And it's sustainable. Most of all, it can be done within a year. And relatively cheap, $150,000. And we've come a long way in this 1 year. So if you guys have, further interest and would like to, you can contact either Andrea or myself. So, thank you.
Especially you touch